everyone, and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I am the host of this show. Now, what else could we possibly do this week but that yes vote, such a profound moment for the country? So in the studio, I've brought in some of the main parliamentary players, Labor's Penny Wong, the Liberal man Dean Smith, whose bill will translate the majority yes vote into law, and a fellow Liberal, James Patterson. Now, James is a yes voter, but he threw a late spanner in the works. So I had a few tricky questions I wanted to ask him. That's coming up towards the end. But let's open in the first instance with Penny Wong, who had to carry that profound yes moment for the entire country. So Penny Wong, thank you for coming on the show.
It's good to be here.
Now I'm going to start with your very, very, very favourite topic. You.
Oh, excellent. Happy about that.
Yes, I wish the listeners could see her face at this point. Okay, so let's just start with the easy question. How do you feel having lost control in front of the entire country?
Somewhat embarrassed.
Is that how you feel? Embarrassed?
A little bit. But I guess that's actually a smaller part of the feeling. I think I just feel exhausted and relieved and grateful, actually. I feel really grateful.
Yes.
That we're here and not where we might otherwise have been. So, well, I think that's probably the biggest part of how I feel right now.
But I'm not going to go full Dr. Phil in this conversation with you, but seriously, like, the worst thing for you is kind of what happened yesterday, in a way that you're kind of, there you are, full glare of cameras on you, because you are such a composed, relentlessly together public performer. And there's no way that moment yesterday for you could not be personal. There's just no way it couldn't be personal.
No, so, because it is personal, isn't it?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So, but you've gotten on the other side of the moment with it. How are you? I suppose it's, here we are. Don't mind us, listeners. We're just having a little chat. How are you, Penny?
I'm okay. No, as I said, I feel good. I feel tired and need a good sleep and really want to get home to see Sophie and the kids because I haven't seen them yet, and I won't get home till late tomorrow night. But I feel, as I said, relieved and grateful. I mean, it is an odd thing, isn't it, to be in a position where so many Australians see so much a part of you. And I've had to, over the period of the months of and years of this debate, I think, become more able to talk about the personal. So I've sort of become more, is it easier, or become more used to using aspects of my experiences in the public narrative, or accepting that they're part of the public narrative. Yesterday was a little bit different, though, wasn't it? It was on another level.
It was on another level watching you. I have to confess, because I did the journalist thing that you do.
You just watched.
Well, you have to. It's the job. That's the job.
Yeah, is this sort of moment where I thought, oh my goodness, I really am not going to be able to keep this together. And it was like 5 minutes to go, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to keep this together. No way.
No, I saw you do it. It was sort of, I had to position myself because it's the job, right? The job is watching, the watch is, the job is bearing witness. And I saw you come in and I saw the frame of mind you were in, and it hit, it was, everybody in that room was in their own version of that frame of mind. And watching you, because I positioned myself at the front of the room to watch you, because I knew I was going to have to write about it. And there was a moment there where I saw just how difficult that was going to be for you, and I actually had to avert my gaze.
There you go. Too private a moment. Well, it did feel a bit like that. So anyway, are we going to stop talking about this
bit soon? Yes, we are. You should see how uncomfortable she is.
Kishi, can I tell you a funny story, though? Yes. At one point I said, can we please get the cameras off me so I can blow my nose?
Oh, no, yes.
The cameras are still going. I said, please, guys, I really don't want to blow my nose on camera.
Just give me two seconds. No, I did laugh. At that point, I was
like this human.
Well,
it was this like little humorous human moment amidst all of that emotion. It was very, very cute.
Yes, logistics. Don't mind me. I need to blow my nose. Now, one more personal question before we'll get into this debate, which is more important, obviously, and I want your strategist brain, and we need to look a bit forward and a little bit back and a little bit forward. But one more
personal question, just because it's valid and you've raised it yourself. In your Senate contribution in the opening of the debate mm-hmm. on Dean Smith's bill, mm-hmm. You told a story really about yourself, which is quite an interesting one, that in some respects you have been an outsider in your own country from when you were a child, that there's a racial dimension mm. to that. And also then as you grow up and you become an adult, obviously, then there's mm. the dimension of your sexual orientation, mm. which also creates that sense of mm. being an outsider. Now, we all know from our own childhood that childhood conditioning is really powerful, right? Mm. That creates who you are. It shapes you in all kinds of ways. It makes you the person you are. But the question I've got is, this week, did you become less of an outsider in your mm. own country? And if the answer to that is yes, I did, how do you think that might change you?
Yes, I did become less of an outsider. I think all of us who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, I think all of us who have felt that prejudice and discrimination or just the absence of the same rights, it was an enormous act of acceptance by the nation. That's mm. what this survey vote was. It was amidst all of the difficult things which were said and some of the horrible arguments during the campaign, ultimately the majority of Australians engaged in a collective act of acceptance and respect, which was very moving. I wanted to talk about the childhood experience, which I talked about in my first speech, not so much to sort of rehash it per se, but to try and explain to people what the philosophical, and I suppose there is a psychological aspect to this too, but the kind of philosophical imperative for me and why, for me, this is the obvious and logical and frankly unremarkable extension of a view of the world that is about equality, and that the experience of prejudice and discrimination on the basis of race has always led me, I think, and I hope, to advocating for equality for all. Because that also, for me, mirrors the journey of the Labor Party. And that's what I was trying to say in that speech, that if you ascribe to equality as a sort of overarching principle, fairness as an overarching principle, that logically compels you to where we've got to.
Yeah, well, it's a story about progress in a way. It is. It's a story about how a society can be one thing 30 years ago and another thing 30 years hence.
Yeah, and I remember someone once, occasionally I get people having a go saying, you only ever talk about marriage equality, which is kind of after 15 years of politics and all the jobs I've done is kind of interesting.
Yeah, but that brief period of being finance minister, that next right. period of being client.
I'm only arguing from self-interest. And I think, I truly believe that were I heterosexual, I would have taken the same view. I may not have had the same place in the debate because of who I am, I've had a certain place in the debate and a certain voice, which I came to accept, the responsibility of having in the national debate. But I don't think I would have had a different
view.
Mm.
It seems unlikely to me. And that question about if you're no longer an outsider, what do you reckon?
You might have to ask me that in a few months.
Well, it's a stupid question to kind of chuck on you because it's quite a big question actually. But I'd like you to think about it because it's sort of it is part of your identity in all kinds of ways. Not in some sort of stressed out, reactive, defensive way. But it does explain you in all kinds of ways, in the way that all of our childhood experiences explain us.
Well, I don't know what the answer to that is. I remember Keating, that one time I went overseas when I was younger, when Paul Keating was Prime Minister, and it was in that period he was really talking about our place in Asia and Asian identity, and he talked about Kokoda and the fall of Singapore being as important to who we were as who we are as the Gallipoli. And I remember coming back from Malaysia after seeing Dad and landing at in Sydney in a beautiful sort of summer day with bright, bright sunlight, and thinking, this is the first time I actually feel like I'm coming back to my country. Mm-hmm. And I remember that feeling. So I wonder maybe whether part of why yesterday was so moving and whether I will feel even more like this is my country.
Yeah, mm. Well, I'm curious. Yes. Mm-hmm. And looking forward, mm. we've got a couple of weeks at least of this debate to go. What's your biggest fear looking forward about how this could go pear-shaped? What are you most worried about?
An amendment that the no votes and some of the soft yes votes coalesce around, that becomes untenable for others. Mm. We've got a cross-party coalition at the moment, small C coalition between Liberal and Labor and the crossbench, essentially. And we're broadly on the same page. Well, we're on the same page in terms of we want marriage equality. But obviously there are some in the coalition who want to put in amendments which could make it very difficult for some parts of that coalition. Mm. And I've no... I would have said I've got no doubt they'll try, and they probably will. I have to say, looking at some of the public comments since the results came down, it does seem that a number of the staunch opposers are softening their position.
Mm. You said that an amendment. Your concern is an amendment that
or set of amendments.
Or set of amendments. Right, yes. And specifically, what do you think they could be?
Well, I don't know that I want to give them tactical advice.
Well, let's talk about what they're talking about.
Well, okay. If I always, when it comes to parliamentary strategy, I always try to think about what I would do if I were in their shoes, and that's certainly what I'd be trying to do. Would be. As Matt Canavan has articulated, trying to be putting up amendments under the sort of cover of or the Trojan horse of religious protections that they know will be unacceptable to many people voting yes, and trying to make it more difficult for people to support the bill. So we have to deal with amendments sensibly, ensure that we have a broad coalition, small C coalition of senators who will block amendments which are not consistent with where this vote landed, which is the lessening of discrimination and rather than its increase, and ensure we deliver a bill to the House that will be supported in the House of Representatives.
Is there any room to move on your side on some amendments?
Look, I think Labor is very... I don't think Labor is willing to go down the path of abrogating existing discrimination laws.
So that stuff's just completely no-go.
Well, I don't think Australia is going to go back to a period where people refuse service because of who they are. I mean, that is, that's a time in history long gone.
Well, let's cross our fingers and hope for the best, Penny.
That's right.
Thanks for joining me.
Well, great to be with you.
Now we'll hear from Dean Smith. And we're going to start in this conversation with the personal before broadening out into the political implications of the week. Well, Dean Smith, thank you very much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here.
Okay, let's start with the personal, because obviously this was a very big week for you personally. And you spoke, if I may say so, very movingly in your Senate contribution this week about the culture of the Liberal Party and whether or not you could be yourself in the culture of the Liberal Party. Now, I think the culture of political parties to most people outside politics are just completely mysterious. Mm, well, just have no idea, really. So let's unpack that a little bit. What are you talking about there? What do you mean?
Well, for me, I had to make a decision. The coming out decision for me had various sort of elements to it. One of the elements was if I came out, do I continue to participate in the Liberal Party? I'd been very active in Young Liberals. I enjoyed it. I think it's fair to say that people saw me as a young leader amongst other young people in the Liberal Party. So the choice I had was, if I do come out, does it mean I have to actually abandon my participation in the Liberal Party?
Mm-hmm.
I was very, very clear that having recognised and accepted that I was a gay guy, that I had to be honest with myself, honest with my friends and family. And if I did want a parliamentary career, then I wanted to be honest with people about that. I was prepared for the fact that I may not get very far because I was an openly gay guy in the WA Liberal Party. I remember a very, very dear friend of mine who's now a parliamentarian. We're out one night having a great time in a nightclub in Perth, and he said, "Oh, no, state council's never going to select an openly gay guy." Well, they did.
Look at that.
They did. I've always known I've had to work harder in order to be equal.
Mm-hmm. And what is it? Is it just because? Is it just the obvious that obviously the Liberal and National parties have a spectrum of from quite liberal people to very, very, very conservative people? Is it just that? Is it just what's obvious?
I think it's two things. I think it's also the sort of the demographic. The Liberal Party in Western Australia is ageing. And of course, that's people are younger people are generally more comfortable with gay people and those sort of lifestyle choices. Older people are a little bit more concerned about, a bit nervous about it. And I can understand on one level that here's a group of people, they've known me very, very well, but they're nervous that one day Smith might just walk out in a dress. Now, those people who know me know that ain't going to happen. But
well, you'd look mighty fine in a dress. What are you talking about?
but you see what I'm saying? They're a little bit nervous that there's a part of me that they don't quite know. And I've been open about being gay, but I am a private person. Don't hide anything. I'm just a private person. Mm. But so I've always sort of tried to reassure them by working harder for them. Perhaps worked much too hard, but I've enjoyed it. I had to go there a couple of times. I went to pre-selection a couple of times before I was successful. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, when they saw me keep coming back, I think that's when they thought, okay, this probably is the guy we want, because he's a fighter.
Because you're persistent.
He's a fighter, and he's persistent.
Now, I had Penny Wong in with me in the studio, and I asked her what her biggest fear was over the next several weeks. And she said that a coalescence would start to form around an amendment or a series of amendments that would become impossible for the cross-party group to stay together on, to support. So if I'll ask you the same question, what's your biggest concern over the next few weeks?
Well, my biggest concern is slightly different to Penny's, and this is what was top of mind for me when I was framing my contribution yesterday in the speech introducing the bill. I worry that the respectful tone might be lost, or that there could be some sort of fraying of emotions.
In the parliamentary debate, you mean?
In the Senate debate.
And what do you mean by that?
If people feel like they're not being heard, or if people feel like they're not winning, and winning is, you know, the thing that's most important to them, then judgments get skewed. Trust gets broken. So in my contribution yesterday, I was really trying to say, you know, we're in this together. This is the parliamentary process at its best. We deal with amendments to bills all the time. We can trust the process. Yesterday's second reading contributions, I think, were very good. Were very good. Were very, very gracious. So I'm an optimist, cautious optimist, still on these things. On the issue of amendments and the way forward, I mean, there are various options available to us. I think that people's ideas or concerns need to be tested. And it is important that if there's a new idea that hasn't been tested through the Senate committee process that got us to this bill, then let's put it into a Senate committee process. That's not about delay. We can do that in 3 or 4 months. But it means that community stakeholders, religious leaders, others get to have a say. The Senate committee process is tremendously robust, and it does get good outcomes. And that's something that was alluded to already in the Senate committee report. I think we can get there. Yes, I think we can get there. But it is going to require a bit of vigilance, most definitely.
And you've had, just on the carve out of religious freedom, which is sort of has been your position, we should explain to the listeners, that you've had the view that there may be religious freedom issues that are kicked up through this debate.
Yes.
That people can make valid arguments about the protections in your bill, whether they're sufficient or not. You've suggested an alternative process, that the religious freedom be considered considered in another committee process earlier in the year. Now, you've had some public endorsements for that from some key Conservatives, Peter Dutton being notable amongst them.
I saw that this morning,
That's it's interesting that that seems to be okay with Conservatives who matter as opposed to Conservatives who just might be noisy.
Yes.
So put that to one side. There are, though, other Conservatives who are saying to me that that's all very well and good to have that separate religious freedom process. However, we'll still push for amendments during the legislative debate about same-sex marriage. And we might do that in concert with some Labor parliamentarians who are currently no votes or abstentions. Mm. So what do you think about that?
The first point I'd make, and this is what I've said to people, that the form in which amendments will come fall into one of three categories. There are those what I would call technical amendments. Oh, Senator Smith, you forgot to dot the I here and cross the T. That's all fine. Then there are what I would call posturing. So the posturing amendments are people who say, look, I've got to send a signal to that narrow base of people that I represent that I'm really fighting for them, even though I know it is not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I understand that, I get the politics of it. I don't think it's a gracious way to go, but there will be some of those. There won't be too many, but there'll be some of them. And then there are what I would call necessary or cosmetic. How do we let people know that we have actually heard them?
Mm-hmm.
That we do think, okay, that is a fair point. And then how you, and then the actual remedy might be to amend my bill, or it actually might be to say, well, actually, your idea is a worthy one, but it actually fits better over here in the Sexual Discrimination Act, or actually, because the religious freedom issue is so broad, why don't we investigate a religious freedoms bill? But I've been very clear, the Smith bill is a bill for same-sex marriage, and it protects people's religious views about marriage, being very specific. And I actually think that is a good legislative approach. And parental rights and these sorts of other issues,
because that's where they'll go.
That's where they'll go. I think the first question is, how, where in our legislative architecture do you actually deal with that? And actually, is all of this effort in the Senate the right place, or is it not more prudent to be arguing the case with state governments?
Well, Simon Birmingham through the week said on some of the parental, that parental area, that some amendments that people might bring forward could be unconstitutional.
Well, this is exactly right. And I think this is a really important point. It's only in the last few weeks that people are saying, oh, we've got all of these issues. But the Fair Work Act's been around for many, many years. The Sexual Discrimination Act's been very... What, people have hidden these issues?
And that's right. So, hitherto under a rock until...
So I've sort of, for my own part, sort of laid out a bit of a first, second, third principles approach. The first principle is, what's the deficiency in our laws at the moment? Then what is the evidence for that? Don't just say there's a problem. What is the evidence for that? And then having agreed that, the third principle is, well, what is the best remedy? Is it actually Dean's bill, or is it actually somewhere else? And I'm very open to that, because these issues are ongoing, because the country is evolving. We saw that in Wednesday's result. The country is evolving. And religious conservative people in the parliament may not want to hear this, but religious freedoms are about religious freedoms for all faiths.
That's right.
And do we want to create special religious freedom laws for particular types of faiths?
Some, but not others.
Exactly. So it could actually open a can of worms. Now, that's okay. We can deal with that. But just, I'm saying, be careful what you wish for.
Well, it is a bit strange, too. I'd put this to James Patterson when I had a conversation with him, to sort of see various right-wingers now lining up on the side of a mini Bill of Rights for religion. It seems a little bit odd to me.
This is, I think, the most peculiar of circumstances. Surprising to read Conservative commentators arguing for bills of rights. I'm not arguing for a bill of rights. I will not be arguing for a bill of rights. Interesting to see some conservatively minded people using international treaties to justify their positions when I participated as the chairman of the Joint Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, Some of these people, also committee members, argued strenuously against having our international human rights obligations
yes.
encroach further and further. And that's a view I agree with. That's a view. So everyone's a bit messed up on this.
Well, everyone really needs to be consistent, is what you're saying politely.
That's right.
Yes. Now, one more question. Are you quite confident that the numbers exist for a sensible resolution to the vote we saw this week? Are you quite confident that the numbers are there now and that the numbers will hold through this process?
I'm quietly confident, and I'll tell you why. This will probably get me into trouble. I do think the Prime Minister has been emboldened by the outcome on Wednesday. It's been a great outcome for the issue. It's been a great outcome for the country. And it might actually just be that dose of mojo that the Prime Minister has been looking for, searching for, aching for. And what I know about the party, having been immersed in it for so long, is that when the leader is able to demonstrate strength and a clarity of purpose, people fall in behind. Mm-hmm. So this actually could be dawning of a really interesting period for the government.
Now, last but not least, James Patterson. I started with an easy question. I started by asking him whether his bill was just a gesture to curry favour with power brokers in Victoria.
I've telegraphed my views kind of well in advance, and they're genuinely sincerely held.
But what about, though, obviously you live in a political context. You're a Victorian senator in the Liberal Party in Victoria. You need to be pre-selected. You need to maintain your position in the hierarchy down there. It's common knowledge, obviously, that there's a big sort of move on by evangelical forces in the Victorian branch. One could, if one was of a cynical disposition, one could say to you, well, is this just gesturing to power brokers and pre-selectors who are conservative in Victoria? I mean, they're the people in the ascendancy. So I'm going to ask you the question, is this just gesture from you? I know you've said, look, I've been sincere, I've been consistent, what else do you want? Mm. But nonetheless, you live in a context, and that's the context. So
are you
gesturing? Are you genuflecting before various people?
Catherine, there are much easier ways to win the hearts of Liberal Party branch members who have a say in pre-selection than doing something like this. I mean, if my objective was primarily about getting pre-selected again, there's a lot of lower hanging fruit than this. This is a very big undertaking, and it's something that I knew would attract a lot of criticism and controversy. So if my objective, if my primary motivation was about getting pre-selected again, this is not the path I would have taken.
Well, it certainly did generate a lot of controversy, a lot of controversy. And it is indefensible, James, isn't it, to suggest that you legalise a form of commercial discrimination, that commercial outlets, bakers, florists, whomever they are, actually have a legally protected right to refuse service to certain people based on their orientation. That is, in essence, the work you produced. How on earth does a person who is, you and I have known each other for quite a long time, I believe your views on freedom and the propagation of it are very sincerely held. I cannot for the life of me understand why you would advance such a concept, which is risible and indefensible, isn't it?
Well, I'll do my best to explain. It's not motivated by any desire to treat gay people unfavourably or any less equally. The problem we have here is the problem of competing rights. So I accept absolutely that the right to non-discrimination is a human right, and it's a worthy one of protection. And actually, our protections for it in Australia are very extensive and very strong. But equally, there are other human rights which are also important. Religious freedom is one, freedom of speech is another, freedom of conscience is another, freedom of association is another. And not always, sometimes those rights don't clash, but sometimes they do. And when they do clash, you are making a choice between the two of them. Now, generally in Australia, the consensus is that discrimination, the right to non-discrimination should take precedence over those other rights. But we should be honest about what happens then. That means other human rights are diminished. The right to freedom of religion and freedom of speech is diminished when non-discrimination, the right to non-discrimination, takes precedence over it.
Sure, but your proposal goes beyond religious protections. It talks about conscientious objection, which could mean anything. I could just be a person of conscience who doesn't like gay people, and my right not to like gay people and participate in their in a very important event for a gay couple, i.e. wedding, is protected. In what universe is that reasonable?
Well, religious freedom is really just a subset of freedom of conscience. We believe that you should be able to have and hold your own beliefs. Now, I'm agnostic, and so I wasn't raised in any religious way. I don't have any religious faith. Are my values any less worthy of protection than someone who bases their values on religious belief? I don't think so, and I'd be interested to see anyone on the left say, genuinely, that religious belief is a special category of belief that is more worthy of protection than other people's beliefs. I don't accept that. I think that religious belief is, although very important, it is only important and mostly important in the context of being a part of freedom of conscience.
Let's think about religious freedom because this seems to be sort of where we're washing up. And rather than punch you endlessly about your bill and why I don't like it very much,
it's very kind of you.
Let's look forward. Let's look forward. It looks. I don't know if you've caught up with Peter Dutton's comments. He's now suggesting, although he's leaving his options open on what amendments he may support through the process of debating this bill over the next few weeks. He's broadly, to my ear anyway, endorsed Dean Smith's concept, which is religious freedom could be dealt with separately in the new year in a debate about religious protections. And that way you kind of lift it out of the marriage process and you deal with it separately. That's obviously something Dean Smith wants to happen. Dutton, to my ear, is endorsing that. What's your view on that?
I don't have any objection at all to the Parliament taking steps to positively protect religious freedom. But I don't think we should therefore say that there are no amendments necessary in this process to ensure that religious freedom is protected. And the reason I say that is that the Parliament's had 117 years to do something about positively protecting religious freedom, and it hasn't done so yet. So a promise to do it at some point in the future doesn't seem like a very strong promise to me. And in fact, no less than the United Nations, our Human Rights Commission and others have called on Australia to do more to particularly support Article 18 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is religious freedom in essence, and we haven't done so. We've been called on to do that many, many times. So it's great to see people talking about this issue. I'm pleased that this debate has sparked greater interest in that issue, but I think they are linked, and I think we have to, and I'd be happy for us to deal with them both in part in this bill and also further down the track, but I wouldn't be happy to only rely on us doing it down the track.
But how because you guys basically, you haven't got the numbers. That's the bottom line, isn't it? If tell me what I'm missing here, James, because I'll step through this conceptually, right? At the moment, if the cross-party group holds, these terms are always so stupid and limiting, but let's call them moderates for what it's worth, right? If the moderates in your own show, so Dean Smith and Simon Birmingham and those guys, if they remain fixed that the Smith bill is it, and maybe you'll do a couple of cosmetic things, but certainly nothing beyond that, that you don't seem to have the numbers to force any other outcome. So what am I missing here?
Well, I would definitely agree that the numbers are not there for my bill to pass the Parliament. I completely accept that. I think there will be goodwill and support for some amendments to Dean Smith's bill.
Such as?
It's too early to say at this point in the process, but for example, George Brandis has foreshadowed two amendments that he will be personally moving, both of which I think are very sensible. One is to ensure that that right of conscientious objection that I want is applied to civil celebrants in a way that it is not in Dean Smith's bill. So that would be to broaden those protections. Another is to have a positive protection for freedom of speech in the bill. That's something I think is a really good idea. Now, if someone like George Brandis, with his standing as Senate leader, as the Attorney General, and as someone who generally I think people would say comes from the moderate side of the Liberal Party, is moving amendments like that. I think that shows that there is genuine interest across the parliament in moving these amendments. And one other thing which I think is everyone should bear in mind, and we'll only know this for sure when we see it, but the Labor Party was bound on process and procedure, and that's why they all voted to introduce Dean Smith as the preferred bill. The Labor Party is not bound on policy.
Mm.
And there are a number of Labor MPs in both the Senate and the House who, to my understanding, want to see stronger religious protections. Whether they're willing to vote accordingly and demonstrate that on the floor of the Senate is a different question, and we will find that out. But there's definitely at least a grouping within the Labor Party who thinks that we can and should go further.
It's tricky though for those people that you mentioned, the Labor folks, because they haven't got a lot of flexibility. If you're a no vote, if you're a Labor Catholic right no vote, what are you going to do? You're going to amend a bill which legalises same-sex marriage, and then you're going to vote no. You see the problem? Mm. It's sort of, it is difficult. If those that block in Labor are no votes as opposed to abstentions, or whatever, I don't know that how much room they've got to move to say, well, yes, actually, I accept that, but I don't accept the concept of legalising marriage equality.
Oh, look, I think regardless of how any MP plans to vote on the final piece of legislation, and my intention is to vote yes, regardless of how they plan to vote on the final piece of legislation, they're absolutely entitled and should vote on everything up until that point as well, on amendments, because they all have views about whether those amendments are good or bad and whether they should be supported or not supported. So to my knowledge, the only Member of Parliament who is absolutely definitely voting no is Corey Bernardi. Most others have said they'll either vote yes or they may abstain.
Mm-hmm.
They can certainly abstain on that last vote about whether or not this bill should become law, but I don't see why they wouldn't exercise their votes on, you know, substantive weighty matters during the process through amendments.
Now, just I stopped punching you about your bill, but just one final punch. It was terrible, wasn't it, your bill?
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was.
Do you sincerely not think it was?
Yes, I sincerely not think it was.
Elements of it?
No, I don't accept that it was terrible.
You haven't gone away and had a little think and thought, maybe?
No, I'm proud of what I've done because it has put a real spotlight on these issues in the way that it was not before, and it's forced people to confront the trade-offs that we have and the implicit assumptions that we make. Most people are happy to not have to confront the fact that anti-discrimination law comes at the expense of other freedoms. And people might be happy to make that trade-off, but they should at least be aware that they're making that trade-off. And if I hadn't proposed my bill, then I don't think people would have had that realisation or come to that realisation. And I don't think we'd see already the broad consensus that some amendment is necessary. Let's see how far it goes. Okay. But I think there's a broad consensus some amendment is necessary.
Fine. But it's like now you're a legislator now, James. You're not in a think tank anymore. You're not conducting a public seminar. You're a legislator. You have power over people's lives and you participate as part of a government passing legislation. And you've not had a moment's pause about what you produced. It hasn't given you cause to think maybe I overshot that.
I've certainly heard loud and clear that my concept of conscientious objection is certainly not popular on Twitter and has, I think, probably mixed reaction in the community. I mean, seriously, there have been a lot of polls on this issue in recent times that have showed, including a Guardian poll, that about half of Australians do support a commercial conscientious objection measure.
Yeah, so, I've seen that data.
There is real genuine support out there in the community for it, and my suspicion is that support will increase when, sadly, this issue is not addressed, same-sex marriage becomes law, and the first lawsuits start to happen, as we've seen in other countries. And my biggest concern is that will spoil what should be a really positive development for Australia and that we should all be really warmly receiving. I think it will put a sour note on it if there are a series of court cases. So I really hope I'm wrong, and maybe Australia is not as litigious as the United States, where there have been a lot of these cases and some parts in Europe. But I do fear that we're going to be revisiting these issues in a few months' time or longer, because someone's, you know, livelihood and life has been destroyed because they just want to hold true to their sincerely held belief.
I guess we'll see. Let's wrap it there.
We will. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to our blockbuster episode this week. Now, don't forget to subscribe to the series in the event that you like the listening. My personal and deep felt and always thank yous to the producer of this program, Miles Martignoni, and he's assisted this week by David Constable. I also need to remind you that Guardian Australia has a wonderful new podcast, Common Ground is its name, and you can search for it easily in the same way that you search for me. Wrap your ears around it if you haven't experienced it yet. And I'll be back with you sooner rather than later. Stay well and stay hopeful.